Good afternoon once again. Perhaps more than any other man, Abraham is known for his faith. He is sometimes called, and I think correctly so, the father of the faithful. You know, Abraham was one of those individuals that believed God, the scriptures tell us, and it was accounted to him for faithfulness. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 recounts the story of the faithful down through time. And I just like to read certain passages here by way of introduction to the sermon. Hebrews chapter 11. I'd like to begin with verse 6 because it makes a very concise and precise statement with regard to faith. But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. This speaks to a central issue of our time. We are now a culture in which it is no longer widely accepted that he exists. Hence, the consequence of that is that faith has been considerably diminished. And there is consequence for that. And then what I'd like to do is to read the ensuing passages as we go forward from verses 8 through perhaps verse 22. But before we do that, I'd like to give you the concept and the title of the sermon. The concept and the title of the sermon today is By Faith and By Fear, The Law of Reward and Consequence. By Faith and By Fear, The Law of Reward and Consequence. One could probably categorize all acts and all accomplishments and all consequences into these two broad categories. That something was either done by faith on solid, logical, rational basis, or it was done by fear, which is usually irrational, illogical, and comes with negative consequences. Most of our world is operating under the motivation of fear. No change occurs, we are told, until, you know, the fear of greater consequence gets to the point where it is so uncomfortable to stay the way we are that we then must change. And that is, if you look at it from a behavioral psychology standpoint, largely true. So today, in the time we share, I'd like to explore the concept of by faith or by fear, the law of reward and consequence. Let's take a look at verse 8 here. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would afterward receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. Now, I will argue, as I always do, that the Bible does not advocate irrational, illogical actions. And at first glance, this might appear illogical, except that there was a issue of faith involved here, and it was not illogical because Abraham had gotten to know God, and he knew that to follow him was the right thing to do, because there was a promise of inheritance, and Abraham believed God to be faithful, and it has turned out that that has been the case, not just in Abraham's lifetime, but down through history. As God has maintained his promise to the descendants of Abraham on a world scene, God has demonstrated his faithfulness as a response to Abraham's action by faith. Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place which he would out to the place which he would afterward receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham followed God because he believed not only in the benefit of doing so now, but more importantly, in the benefit of doing so for the future. Abraham, we are told in the Genesis accounts, did really well for himself as he journeyed through the land of Canaan, even as a sojourner at the time. I mean, he went about his work. He practiced living and following God. He was not a hermit that isolated himself from everybody else because, well, I mean, he was more pious than they were. And no, Abraham was an active participant in life and in the culture of his day and had impact and influence on hundreds of servants, we are told. But despite that, it was his journey of faith. The idea of the future reward both for his descendants inheriting a physical promised land and more importantly the eternal life that was promised as we read here in the city whose foundation and builder and maker is God was never far from his mind. I think that is at least my challenge. If it is not yours, but I reckon it probably is, the challenge is always to strike an appropriate balance between those two. And that is the sureness of the kingdom of God yet future in all its trappings and benefits and our responsibility to live today the way God would have us live in the future as preparation for that. And I think Abraham and many of those people that we will look at today struck a balance. But, as I do, as I suspect you do, not always a very good or at least not a perfect one. Continuing in verse 12. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. I mean, the impossibility of conception and birth at nearly 100 years old ended up becoming the forebears of millions of people. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. So here you have the balance. By faith. And, you know, by faith is one of those words. It's kind of like repent and other religious and pious-sounding words. I mean, it's been so overused. You know, you have by faith, my faith, your faith, his faith, faith. What does it really mean? I mean, if we're not careful, it becomes meaningless, and yet God told us in verse 6 that without faith it is impossible to please him. So here you have again, on the one hand declaring plainly that we seek a homeland, that this is not it, this life is not ultimately my goal. But in doing so, we must be very careful that we do not become sedentary in our practice of faith today. Because in doing so, we will lose the future one. Continuing, and truly if they had called to mind the country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. I love reading this chapter. I mean, it is powerful in its construction, you know, just as a piece of literature. But it is even more powerful in painting a picture of a future reward that far exceeds any consequential issues that we might be confronted with in this life. The other thing that I would like you to keep in mind as we get into this is the fact that this is an enumeration of individuals that are considered patriarchs, but they were not perfect at all if you look at their lives. And that should be, I think, at least for me, very encouraging. By faith, verse 23, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. They did it by faith, not by fear. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. So the fact that Moses looked forward enabled him, and this I think is key. The fact that we can look forward with confidence should enable us to more effectively practice faith today. Because in doing so, we should not be as inhibited by fear and motivated and constrained by it as our counterparts in our, shall we say, faithless culture. You know, being controlled by fear is the worst enslavement. And it causes us to make decisions. And believe me, I know. It causes us to make decisions that have consequences that we do not wish to have. But in the face of fear, in the face, rather, of fear, we often do that. Verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And what more shall I say? For the time will fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Wow, I mean, that is just a wonderful litany of miracles that bolster faith. But then comes the caveat. And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Like I said, I saw that firsthand. We went way back where actually the German literature that I got on this site said that this is so far out back, and I'll translate the German, where fox and rabbits kiss each other goodnight. Now, it doesn't have the same poetic significance. Yes, there is poetic significance in German, I would have you know. But what it means is it's out where the sun don't shine. I mean, it was up way back a valley in the Emmental Mountains where we visited this site where they had put in a false cavity in the wall to hide people. And we had a hard time finding it, even with modern navigation systems like GPS. My GPS couldn't find it, so guess what we did? We turned on Google Maps. Even way back there, Google Maps functioned. They hid in this cavity over the issue of infant baptism. And the proprietor of that farm ended up spending several years in prison because he accommodated them and was deposed from Switzerland. You know, you ask yourself, I ask myself, could I do that? The answer is yes, I could. The bigger question I think we should ask ourselves is, would I? Would I go forward in faith despite torture, not accepting deliverance, or would I order my life by the contrast of faith by fear? And others being tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might have a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings, scourging, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain by the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. You see, that's God's perspective. These were capable, confident, I guess you must say, individuals, of which the world was not worthy. And, you know, we have lived, I think, under the guise that we live in a civilized world, and yet in the last 8 years or so, 5 years, eight, you know, pick the number, civilization seems to be fracturing. You know, dying by the edge of the sword is no longer a theoretical thing. You know, the barbaric executions that we thought we had evolved beyond are part of everyday news now. Beheading, burning people in a cage. I mean, these are tactics that, well, back in the 15th and the 16th century were commonplace. And we as modern individuals kind of look back to that and say, well, these were, you know, they were kind of uncivilized. They were barbarians. I mean, just kind of climbing out of the caves, you know, dragging their women behind them. It's just not true. The barbaric nature the barbaric capability within human beings is never far away. So, we've read this chronicle of faith, and what I'd like to do is to look at five individuals and their journey of faith and fear. We will look at what they did by faith. We will look at what they did by fear, and we will look at the law of reward and consequence. We read here, let's go back and take a look at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. and then we'll go to the account. We started out by looking, by faith, Abraham obeyed. By faith, Abraham obeyed. I mean, the faith that Abraham had, the operative word in this introductory statement is that he obeyed. You know, obedience, the notion that we have, that we need to have a commitment to principles that are not negotiable and adhere to them, which is a form of obedience, is just becoming very foreign to our secular society. It's whatever the flavor of the day is and whatever is expedient. There's a word for it. It's called utilitarian ethics. Utilitarian ethics. Abraham had faith. He did this by faith. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12 and notice how these actions are recorded. And again, we have to bear in mind a lot of this is written in very, shall we say, Reader's Digest version. Abraham had already departed with his father, and then out of Ur in the Chaldeans, and then after Terah died, we read in verse 1 of chapter 12, "Now the Lord had said to Abram," notice it's past tense, "the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." You notice here that the promise for obedience by faith had tangible things attached to it. This wasn't just a... And again, I want to emphasize here that this is a concise version of the conversation. I'm sure as other examples of dialogue between Abraham and his Lord, his God, show that there was a lot more that was discussed here. For example, you know, if you read the account of Abraham debating and challenging God on whether or not he would destroy Sodom, you know, he negotiated with God. So I think that there was a lot more dialogue regarding moving out and what these promises entailed than what is recorded here. But be that as it may, we notice here that we have the two components I cited earlier. You have the promise that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And that was both physical in nature, that would be a blessing that would extend to his literal physical descendants, as well as the spiritual blessing of the coming of Jesus Christ, who was also a descendant of Abraham. So it shows the very fact that this is, as we have sometimes called it, a promise of race and grace. It shows us, I think, the very important significance of the fact that while it is essential that we focus on the future promise that God gives to us through grace and eternal life, it is also very important that we live today as Abraham did. Notice, so Abram departed. I mean, it in one sense, it just simplifies it. I'm sure it wasn't quite that easy. God said, go, Abraham went. I mean, it's kind of the sense of it here. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem. So we see here what we read in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 11. By faith, Abraham departed. He left house and home, his family, and went to the land that was to be given him. Now let's take a look of what Abraham did by fear. It's right here in verse 10. So life happens. Abraham leaves, moves to this new country, and what happens? A famine. I mean, that's life. It's up and it's down. It's challenge and there are trials. Now there was a famine in the land. You know, you can just, paper is so easy. You just write it on there. There was a famine. Big deal. Big deal. He had mouth to feed. So what did he do? And Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there. For the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. That's why he married her, right? Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will not let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, that I may live because of you. So it was when Abram came into Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh, the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. So here you have the father of the faithful, by fear, lying about the identity of his wife. Now, when you think about it, I mean, that is about as cowardly as a guy can get. He disowns his wife to save his own skin. I mean, there's just not much commendable about that, at least not in my book. But here we have Abraham, who is otherwise commended by God on multiple occasions for a man of great faith. And I think what this shows us, brethren, is that, as is the case throughout the Bible, you have men and women of great passion and energy and action who did some really dumb things. And yet, God worked with Abram. There were consequences. I mean, Abram lost credibility in Egypt big time. God prevented things from getting out of hand, and I think this little story here should give us encouragement, because it shows that God was committed to his relationship with Abram. So much so that even though Abram was a cowardly liar in this particular circumstance, God prevented it from getting really bad. He treated Abram well for her sake, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Get out of here. I mean, this is the first Exodus. But the underlying motivation was fear. By faith, Abraham was able to leave his country. By fear, he was a poor, dastardly, cowardly husband that lied about the identity of his wife. He could leave his house, move out of his country, but he didn't have the courage to defend his wife. Those are the facts as described here in the Bible. And yet, we read that Abraham, because he, I mean, this was a real weak point for him. Let's go over to James chapter 2. James 2. James chapter 2, verse 20. "But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead?" I think that kind of sums up fear-based motivation. It leads to some really foolish decisions. You see, when Abram went down to Egypt and attempted to solve to protect his wife through lying, what he was actually doing, I mean, this is a two-way street. Not only was he doing something that made him ultimately look really silly in the face of the Egyptians. Just think about it. You think the princes of Egypt were impressed by Abraham? You know, when he didn't even have the backbone to stand up for his wife? I mean, it's kind of hard to respect a man like that. But that's what he did. He was being foolish. And in doing so, he prevented God from being able to intervene on a faith-based action. Abram could have told his wife that we are going to Egypt. I mean, that may have been the first mistake. But in going to Egypt, Abram should have been a man and clearly identified himself as her husband and protector, and then trusted in God to protect him in that legitimate relationship instead of making up the sister story. Continuing, tracking back now to Abram acting on faith, "Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar?" You see, here you see you see the humanity. You know, there's a book called "Why Do Smart People Do Stupid Things?" I mean, it's it happens every day. I mean, expect dumb people to do dumb things, right? Sometimes dumb people do smarter things than smart people. I mean, it works that way. So you have here a man that could leave his country, who lied not once but twice about the identity of his wife because he was afraid, and then followed through on the command to sacrifice his son. It shows how our humanity is, well, fractured and flawed. It also demonstrates that we have a God that to the extent that we are ever passionate and faithful in our intent and willingly following him, he will make up for those flaws in dramatic ways. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? That's why, brethren, our time is now. Our life needs to be an expression of what in the future we are to become. However imperfect that might be. By faith, it says here, Abraham was made perfect. And if you go back and you read the account when he raised his knife, when God stopped him, God said, "Now I know." The faith that had been fractured and flawed and imperfect was sealed with that event. God knew that Abraham would be faithful. And a scripture was fulfilled which says, Abraham believed God. It doesn't say here that he believed in God. It says that he actually believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So that is the example of Abraham. We read in Hebrews chapter 11 that Jacob, by faith, Jacob, leaning on his staff, blessed the generations to come. Jacob did a lot of other things by faith. But if you go back, as we will, to Genesis chapter 49, we will look at this aspect of Jacob's faith. The blessing that was spoken here. And again, generational blessings in that culture was something that was understood, desired, and valued. As, even in the case of Jacob and Esau, you could see the value that was placed upon it. Something that I think, is it safe to say, is pretty much lost in our culture. It's not to say that there aren't generational blessings, but I think if more attention were given to it, it would be more valued. So here we have in chapter 49 what Paul found worthy of noting in his concise chronicle of faith in chapter 11. Notice verse 1. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." So here, under inspiration of God, there was the understanding that when a patriarch commanded a blessing upon another generation, that God would pay attention and honor that. And in this case, Jacob, under the inspiration of the Spirit, was able to project forward thousands of years to tell his sons what would become of their descendants in the latter days. "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, yet unstable as water, you shall not excel." I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse of sorts. Obviously, Reuben deserved it because he went up to your father's bed and then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. Let not my soul enter their counsel. Dropping down to Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. The scepter, verse 10, shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and he and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Now, the unique thing about this whole conversation or blessing is that other than Judah, the identity of these peoples have been largely lost. Now, Judah is the one whom the brothers shall praise, it says here. We see what is going on in Judah right now. I mean, Israel is not really Israel, even though it bears that label. It is Judah that we see in Israel today. Look at Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the well, and the archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained his strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. Now, we have understood, I believe, correctly, that the United States and the British Empire are, or shall I say, were, largely descendants of Joseph. And what is indisputable is that we have been a fruitful bough by the well, and the branches have run over the well. The benefits to the world that the United States of America and, to a certain extent, Britain have had on the world over the past several centuries is immeasurable. I mean, it's just immeasurable. This is a result of faith. You know, you have in one person, and we're going to look at fear here in a moment, you have in one person faith that has the capacity to predict with uncanny accuracy what is going to occur thousands of years in the future. While at the same time, an individual who has the capacity to fear to run from his brother. I mean, it's a dichotomy. It is the contrast between fear and faith, and I think what the patriarchs show us is that however flawed, if we practice faith, fear can be overcome. So now at a less complimentary side of Jacob. Over in Genesis, chapter 27, I'll pick up in verse 1 and we'll look at a couple of things here. Now it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, that he called Esau, his older brother, and said to him, "My son," and he answered him, "Here I am." And he said, "Behold, now I am old and I do not know the day of my death. Now therefore, please take your weapons and your quiver and your bow and go to the field and hunt game for me and make me savory food such as I love and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now here the family goes to work. The families have this unbelievable capacity to create all kinds of problems. And this was no different. Rebecca overheard this. She didn't go in and, as she should have done, and said, "Isaac, let's think about this. When these two twins were born, we were told that the younger was to that the older was to serve the younger, that he was to have the blessing. You see, we need to think about this." No, she didn't do that. She went to Jacob and said, "Deceive your dad." She cooked up the stew. And Jacob was afraid, as he should have been, because he knew he'd be going in there lying. And so they came up with this whole deception and clothed him in Esau's clothes. And he went in, and Jacob must have really been blind, or rather Isaac, excuse me, because he didn't recognize his son. And he proceeded to bless him. This is a classic example of taking matters into your own hands that God has the prerogative over. Long story short, Jacob got the blessing, Esau didn't. Esau hated Jacob. So what began by fear continued in fear. But, I mean, does have a happy ending. At, you know, the end of, before the end of their lives, they somewhat reconcile. But the consequence of living by fear continue to this day to be played out in the geopolitical arena of the Middle East. They still fight. There's still fear. Let's take a look at verse 41. So Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him, and Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand, that I will kill my brother Jacob." And the words of Esau, her older son, were told Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, flee to my brother Laban in Haran." By fear. By faith. By fear. By faith. The consequence is very different. In Hebrews chapter 11, we learned, let's go there. Hebrews chapter 11, we were given another example. Verse 24, "By faith Moses, when he came of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." In fact, when he discovered his identity, he went out and killed Egyptians. He boldly acted on behalf of his people and was driven out, fled for his life, spent 40 years tending sheep. It says here in Hebrews chapter 11 that he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. His ability to look forward allowed him to live powerfully in the present. Both of those are so critical. Because if we do not live in the present, there's very little probability that we will live in the future. mean, it's just the way it works. By contrast, if we only live in the present without a sure vision of the future, well, then we just live in the present, a lonely and meaningless life. So we have a man here, history tells us, who, as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, had done quite well in Egypt. He was a general, had conquered nations, who had now fled, who was obviously a well-educated and capable individual, who was then chosen by God to lead Israel out of Egypt, who confronted Pharaoh, who led them through the Red Sea into the wilderness, which they were to pass through to go to the Promised Land. And then this man of faith committed an act conceived in fear that caused him to die in the wilderness. We find that over in Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. The children of Israel were once again having water problems. The water plant in the wilderness just wasn't working. There have been any number of solutions to this, and God was going to elevate his stature to a different level, and he was counting on the faith of Moses to do that. When in verse 7, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals. Speak to the rock," was the instruction. I mean, when you think about how this had occurred in the past the command had been to strike the rock. And of course, to the secularly minded, they could have said, well, obviously there was a spring of water hidden in the rock, and when the rod hit it, it fractured the rock and water gushed forward. So God was going to, like I said before, elevate his stature in the eyes of the people, as well as that of Moses, by having him speak to the rock and water coming forth. So now it was indeed supernatural. You see, if Moses had acted by faith here and followed the command, not only would God have been elevated in the eyes of people, but also Moses as the messenger of God. Verse 10, "And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels.'" That was a fair statement. Could have called them a few other names, and he probably did. "Must we bring water for you out of this rock?" He was afraid. He was angry. "Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank." The problem was he referred to himself and Aaron and said, "Must we bring water out of this rock?" Fear-based, not faith-based, and there was consequence. verse 12. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. You see, it was not about Moses. It was not about water. It was about the sovereignty of God. Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. By faith, by fear, the law of reward and consequence. Point number four. By faith, Israel crossed the Red Sea, we're told in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 22. I mean, that was probably the most dramatic act of redemption and emancipation in the history of man to this point. You know, we talk about the Israelites migrating out and the fact that they were 3 million people. Time magazine had an article this week that stated, and I don't know who went counting, that there are roughly 60 million people migrating right now from Africa to the Middle East, trying to find places of refuge. This is a direct result of the destabilization by misguided policies of the United States. I mean, that's just a fact. And, you know, Germany is the primary host of the immigrants pouring into Europe. They are currently 80 million people. They are making decisions based on fear of their past. They're afraid to take logical steps to manage or make the situation manageable, which would include limiting the number of people they can absorb. A country of 80 million cannot absorb even a large portion of 60 million. And something really bad is probably going to happen. Because the taxpayers will eventually say, wait a minute, they live here, get 3 squares a day at my expense, do nothing, trash the train stations. It's the law of reward and consequence. It's fear and faith. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 14 and notice the historical migration that was occurring here. The Red Sea crossing. Verse 11. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? This became their refrain. I mean, this, the essence of this fear-based accusation or statement was repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated until finally it became true. And brethren, that's something that we need to be very careful about, because whenever we tell ourselves internally fear-based statements, we will eventually cause them to become true. Because they're not rational, you know. And I got to, I mean, most of the time when I get a phone call, I mean, most of the time when I get a phone call, it's not good news. It's a problem. We need this. What about that? Well, why can't you do this? I don't like so-and-so. Why did you let so-and-so do this? So yesterday I got a call. My secretary came to me, tapped on the door and said, so-and-so is calling. Wants you to call you back. I thought, oh no. It was the father of the 16-year-old individual that we have training in Germany. What was the first thing in my mind? I thought, uh-oh, something's wrong, you know. So I told my secretary, call him back, tell him it's okay, I'm in a meeting, call him right back. I called him back and he said, hi John, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing great, how can I help you? He said, well, I just wanted to talk to you. Our son is enjoying it, he's doing great. I talked to him about every day, it's amazing what he's learning, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, duh. You think the worst. Now, I know none of you do any of that, right? I'm just burying my soul up here, telling you what you're dealing with. We create our own realities to a large extent. And of course, I was delighted that that was the case. But it's not often that someone calls you just to say how good it's going. It's just not human nature. They call you when they're in trouble. They call you when they're mad. They call you when something's wrong. This was the case here. Verse 13, and Moses said to the people, and this is, I think, a demonstration of leadership. Because he was able in this instance to turn the action of the people from fear-based to faith-based. And here's what he said. Do not be afraid. Don't base your decisions on fear. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see them again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, good job. That was great work, you know, you did with your people. He said, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Do something. Yes, God opened up the Red Sea. That was the miracle. But they, by faith, had to walk through it. And in doing so, it became the operating example. So much so that, again, it was cited by Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank of the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Very complimentary about what they accomplished by faith at the shores of the Red Sea. But, verse 5, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. I mean, these are all things that are relevant today. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. That example is found over in Numbers chapter 21, verses 5 through 9. They acted on their fears, and God sent serpents. I mean, they acted on their fear of thirst. They acted on their fear of any number of things, and they always had. I mean, they as emancipated slaves never were able to put their slavery behind them and actually trust that the God that had delivered them had their best interest at heart. They continued to repeat the lie that God, Moses had somehow got, taken them out into the wilderness for them to die. And eventually, and finally, God allowed them to have their wish. This is fear-based consequence. And finally, here is an example of faith not mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, but I will. By faith, Peter walked on water. By faith, Peter walked on water. Matthew chapter 14. I did that one time down at Tappan. I have a photo to prove it. I'm walking 100 feet right out across Lake Tappan, just, you know, right on the surface of the water. What the photo doesn't show is the wall that was flooded right under it because there had been a flood. It's a great picture. Matthew chapter 14, verse 25. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea, and when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. See? They became irrational very quickly and said, "There's a ghost coming after us." But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid." And then Peter, ever the action-oriented individual, but he acted in faith. And Peter said, answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." No big hoopla, no big instruction. He just said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." Faith and fear in one story, seconds apart. Faith to walk on water and enough fear to sink in it. It's two F words that have a dramatically different outcome. Another example of Peter acting by fear is found over in Matthew chapter 27. Verse 69. Matthew chapter 26, verse 69 rather. Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard. Jesus is being tried in the court. And a servant girl came to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." "Oh yeah, you know, you're one of them." I mean, not, I mean, she wasn't antagonistic. I mean, she just, oh, yeah, okay, you're here, understand. Peter is scared out of his wits. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you are saying. And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. But again he denied with an oath, I do not know the man. And after a while, those who stood by came to him and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them, because your speech betrays you. You're from West Virginia, I can tell by your accent. And if you're from West Virginia, you'll tell them, I can tell you're from Ohio because of your accent. They were from Galilee. They could tell by his speech. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who had said to him, before the rooster crows, he will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. Again, you know, we see this pattern repeatedly, whether it's Moses or Abraham or Elijah or King David, or, you know, you make your own list. The dynamics of faith and fear are at work within individuals who God called and worked through down through history. It shows our humanity, our incredible propensity to failure, and also God's extraordinary power and mercy to support those who, as Hebrews said, diligently seek him. Peter, of course, went on to much greater things, and one of my favorite passages of Scripture is Acts chapter 2, where he preached this powerful sermon that caused thousands of people in one day to repent. Faith and fear, reward and consequence. We conclude over in Psalms chapter 27. Psalm chapter 27. Verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? I mean, that is a psalm of David and a powerful statement. If the Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear? It should not be a factor in our lives, but it is. Because we're human. Of whom shall I be afraid when the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, and my enemies and my foes, they stumbled and fell. Through an army, though an army should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should arise against me, in this I will be confident. One thing I have desired of the Lord, and that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty or the delightfulness of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. That was David's perspective. By fear and by faith, the law of reward and consequence, it is ever present in our lives. But we have a choice to choose faith and to reap reward.